Welcome to the Society for Cardiovascular Pathology podcast. Our society has been dedicated to furthering clinical and research knowledge in the field of cardiovascular pathology since its inception in 1985. We are comprised of a dynamic and collegial group of international professionals working together to foster advancements in cardiovascular disorders. My name is Melanie Boyce, and as your host today, I'm honored to introduce you to Dr. Carolyn Glass, our guest of honor. Dr. Glass is a cardiac and thoracic pathologist at Duke University. She initially trained as a vascular surgeon at the University of Rochester Medical Center, following which she received her PhD in genomics and epigenetics. She then completed a residency in anatomic pathology and a cardiothoracic pathology fellowship at the Brigham and Women's Hospital, with an additional thoracic pathology fellowship at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. She currently serves as the Chief of Cardiovascular Pathology, Director of Duke University Hospital Autopsy Service, and the Co-Director of the Division of Artificial Intelligence and Computational Pathology. Dr. Glass, we could not be more thrilled to have you here with us today. Welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me, Melanie. It's a pleasure.
I'd like to start off by discussing your role in the Division of Artificial Intelligence and Computational Pathology at Duke University. It's a fascinating area, and many see artificial intelligence as the gateway into more efficient workflows and more accurate patient results within the realm of anatomic pathology. This makes what you and your colleagues are doing really pivotal to the future of our profession. Can you tell us a little more about the collaboration with AI Health and the primary initiatives of your division?
Sure, I can start off by just stating our overall mission and our goals of the division. Mainly our mission is to support translational research by developing AI or artificial intelligence assisted technologies for image analysis so we can enhance diagnoses, classification of diseases, even prediction or prognostication of a variety of diseases, including cancer, medical, as well as transplantation. And we really want to see the application of these novel technologies to really improve patient care. That's our ultimate goal. So hopefully along the way, we can prepare the next generation of pathologists and scientists to adopt these technologies as well.
And then how are you applying these principles and goals to the field of cardiovascular pathology?
Well, a few years ago, when I first started, my interest was started in AI. It was really in the area of cancer. I was training in thoracic pathology and trying to diagnose specific types of cells and what they most likely related to. But anyways, as I started my faculty position, and here at Duke, we have a very, very high volume of both lung and heart transplantation patients. So I really wanted to apply it to transplantation. And so we started off with the most basic diagnoses, which would be, of course, acute cellular rejection and less frequently antibody-mediated rejection, although it's less frequent, but has a very meaningful impact on patient prognosis. So what we did is we started to annotate and see if we can apply an algorithm to see if computer or computer assistance can actually help us in areas where there was high inter-observer variability for diagnosing ACR or AMR.
What do you foresee as the next steps in this initiative?
Well, we have some preliminary data in the area of diagnosing, for example, in ACR, we have some algorithms that can help us detect if lymphocytic infiltrate actually damages the myocytes or doesn't. That's obviously a very important key factor when we're trying to come up with severity or 1R versus 2R, because you want to see that myocyte damage present. So we have a tool for that. But we also we're working on some things, for example, for Quilty lesions. So as we see enough cases, we wonder, well, is that Quilty lesion? Is that infiltrative Quilty? Or is that, because those can sometimes cause damage as well, or is that really rejection? And so we're looking into some algorithms to see if we can help with assistance with that. For AMR, it can be difficult if you're just looking at the histologic aspect of AMR. So AMR is defined as, you know, we define it by the histologic component and then the immunologic component. But when we have hearts that are healing, we're trying to figure out if it's more of a healing injury or actual the histologic component of AMR. It gets a little tricky. And we actually did a test amongst all our three cardiac pathologists here. And, you know, it's pretty variable. And I can't imagine how much more variable it'll be amongst, you know, all of us throughout the country. So we actually did run an algorithm and they actually did better than the pathologists in terms of variability of the age component of AMR. So I think our next step is really to see if we can expand this, not just to for our institution, but really we want to make this a multi-institutional effort. And I think that's where being involved with Society of Cardiovascular Pathology and really having a strong network of those in the academic as well as community pathologists would be important to really make this applicable for quality assurance purposes to be able to collaborate in that way.
Absolutely. I mean, this all sounds incredibly fascinating and extremely promising in the diagnosis and interpretation of transplant cardiac pathology. I guess as we start to look into this, it all sounds so positive. Do you foresee any pitfalls in the application of AI to cardiac transplantation pathology, or is it all a really rosy outlook?
Oh, definitely not a rosy. Nothing is that rosy, but yes, I think anything that's worth doing, you're always going to have pitfalls and problems and challenges and hiccups. And I don't think this is anything different. When one speaks about AI and technology, and just like when molecular first kind of came on the scene, you have to be concerned about, well, where is this going to take us? You know, not just, yes, it's easy to help us diagnose things. And I think some questions that arise would be, well, is this going to take our job? You know, how is this going to affect data sharing? Can you just share data with anybody and treat it like research? So I think there are some areas in the areas of ethics as well as regulatory that are hurdles. And I think the FDA and other regulatory institutions are already looking at that and have so in the last few years. It's a moving target, but these are areas that I think that we're trying to organize at a higher level. I do know that the College of American Pathologists has a group, an AI working group, which I'm involved with, and we're trying to work through these issues and work with FDA and other agencies to make sure that the patient's data and these kind of issues are handled in an appropriate manner. So.
Absolutely. And so with all of these very impressive and positive steps in the field of transplantation pathology, can you take these concepts of AI and then translate it to other areas of thoracic pathology? In particular, what other areas are you thinking that this could really apply positively toward?
Yes, absolutely. My heart is dear to transplant and cardiopathology, being a cardiac fellowship trained pathologist. Whatever you set your mind to, it can be applicable. I'm also a thoracic pathologist, so I see a lot of lung cancer. I don't do cytopathology, but I do more surgical pathology, although there are a lot of AI applications also in cytopathology currently. For lung cancer, it's very interesting where a lot of the tools can be applied to look at the landscape of certain tumors, not just the tumor itself, but maybe understanding how the patient tissue responds to certain drug regimens. For example, you have patients who are taking checkpoint inhibitors, and less than 50% of patients actually respond to it. They do well, but many don't. And we're trying to figure out maybe at the tissue level, are there certain clues that we can find that may be associated with those that respond and those that don't respond? We can look at the immune infiltrate, not just the quantification of certain inflammatory cells like, you know, lymphocytes, plasma cells, and other things, but what is the actual architectural organization of those cells and those that respond and don't respond? And can we use those patterns to help us predict if somebody's going to do well on a certain drug? So those are the kind of big picture things that we're looking at.
Your passion for this really comes through when you speak about it. How did you get interested in AI-related initiatives? I know you alluded to it earlier, but I'd like to hear your story.
So when I was a fellow in Dallas, we were looking at lung cancers. And so PathAI is one of the largest AI companies out there now that's really dedicated to mostly cancer. And I believe their breast cancer was their first area of focus. But they were looking for those to help annotate. And so in order to actually come up with an algorithm or develop an algorithm, you need to train your computer or train your algorithm to actually put the data into the right buckets. I emphasize this greatly is I think the training set and the input of people who are annotating those training sets, the skill level or the accuracy of that is really important because, you know, you don't want to be putting in data or saying something is the gold standard and then using that to come up with the answer. So anyhow, as a PathAI had this huge organized structure using requesting certain pathologists to see if they can annotate things. And I thought that was very interesting. And the more and more I learned about the company and what their goals were, which were really against treatment response in breast cancer and how we can use histology to make things a little bit more accurate or predict response to therapy. I thought it was just a really cool idea and a cool model to see if we can do things a little bit more accurately. I wanted to really expand this into my area of interest, which of course was heart and lungs. I knew that wherever I ended up, I wanted to use this or implement this kind of technology.
Very interesting. I'd like to switch gears just a little bit now. And I was really interested to see that you were originally trained as a vascular surgeon. Can you tell us a little bit more about the change in your career path and why you decided to obtain certification in anatomic pathology?
Yeah, of course. I get that question a lot. So I trained in vascular surgery in the integrated vascular surgery program, which brought me up to very cold upstate New York. So when I graduated medical school in 2007, I didn't want to do a general surgery program, mainly because I had already been in medicine for about 4 years. I went to medical school pretty late. So surgery was actually my second career, and being a pathologist is my third career. But when I was a medical student, you know, I was interested in visualization of organs. I mean, it was just cool, you know, so you have certain interests, you gravitate toward, you know, radiology, pathology, you know, surgery, but you like actually get to like see physical organs. So I enrolled in an integrated vascular surgery program where you could do it in 5 to 6 years instead of the usual 9 years, which brought me up to New York at University of Rochester, which was a great program for vascular. But I think there were certain areas that I became more aware as I proceeded through the program. And I did 4 of the 6 years. I realized that I really like to figure out the why more so than the fixing part of things. You know, so I think I view medicine as you have the figure out the why or figure out how to fix it. And I saw myself more as wanting to spend more time dedicated to the translational aspect of why things happen versus fixing it. So that was a little bit of a reason why my passion kind of led me toward more of a diagnostic bent. And then I also think there are other circumstances. I mean, everybody was so supportive, which was really helpful. I know that's not the case in a lot of transitions, but I think when I decided that I wanted to leave the field and kind of pursue something where I can balance more translational research as well as medicine, so I decided to get my PhD. So while I was trying to raise my son, who was he was 0 to 3 years old when I was doing my PhD. I did my PhD under a hematopathologist. So that's when I kind of got a lot of exposure to what pathology was. Because to be honest, even up until, you know, my 4th year of vascular surgery residency, I had no idea what a pathologist did. So, and then more and more I learned, I thought it was just so rewarding and so critical. Pathologists play such a background role, I think. You know, we're not really seen in the eye and we don't as, you know, most clinicians, but I really saw how critical a pathologist was in terms of steering patient care. That's kind of how it turned for me. It was more of a self-discovery, I guess. Yeah.
Oh, it's a fascinating story. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. I can only imagine that that past experience, not only your work in your vascular surgery fellowship and training, but also in your PhD, really augments your work as a cardiovascular pathologist now. Yeah. Do you see that in your practice?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, I've been in healthcare now for 26 years. It may have not been all in pathology or surgery or medicine, but it's, you know, a total of 26 years. And I don't think any of that has been wasted, because I think with every little experience that you have, I first started off as a physician assistant, a PA, because I thought I would be a kind of international mission worker. And I enjoy traveling and really doing primary care, you know, for areas that didn't have any access to healthcare. I started off doing that, and then I got into research and then surgery and now pathology. But I feel like with every little experience, you know, I think things are kind of synergizing now. For example, you know, I think my passion, even if it started with like kind of international care, I can use AI tools to help those who don't have access to care by, you know, making diagnostics more accessible in certain ways. And we're kind of using tools right now to do that. We're actually doing a COVID AI project where we can diagnose things possibly using peripheral blood smears, and if, you know, for labs that don't have access to PCR. So projects like that, I kind of see things full circle. And even with this whole COVID pandemic, you know, the fact that I trained as a vascular surgeon and a lot of the etiology or the pathophysiology that underlies COVID as a pathologist, I can appreciate it better because of my vascular surgery training, because I spent 4 years stenting folks who had clotting issues. And now I have an opportunity to study at the tissue level what is really going on, you know, with clotting. And I think to me, it's exciting that after all this training, that I can use different skill sets to kind of synergize and hopefully improve healthcare. So
your work in your PhD was really focused in genomics and epigenetics, and that also reflects another area of your academic research interests. You're passionate about the identification of biomarkers that can inform patient response to conventional and targeted therapies in the setting of malignancy. Can you tell us a little bit about your research in this area too?
Oh, sure. So in terms of epigenetics, back in 2011, that's when I think whole genome sequencing was, at least it was exciting at that point in 2011. It was very expensive too. Now you can sequence someone, sequence for very little cost and very quickly. So my PhD work was in infant leukemia, hematopathology. The most useful thing for me when I was a PhD student was understanding the model and the technology behind things more so than the, you know, the actual disease process, although that was interesting. A lot of the assays that I learned as a PhD student was not just understanding the mutations of someone, but how are the genes regulated? What phenotype happens when not just if there's a mutation, but if something goes awry with things that are controlling, you know, the actual genome machinery? So that's kind of a definition of epigenetics, is kind of the regulatory aspect of things. Because, for example, in lung cancer, you know, we have, let's say, EGFR mutations and ALK and ROS and these kind of rearrangements, but the frequency of those things are so rare. I mean, EGFR is not as rare, but there's just so many more processes in molecular alterations that I feel that can be targeted, but just hasn't been explored yet. It's hard to move technology forward. It's expensive too. So I'm interested in trying to figure out if we can find specific biomarkers, not just the mutations themselves, but biomarkers that regulate molecular type alterations. Because I think the more epigenetic or these kind of biomarkers we find, we have more chance to find medications or targets to prevent whatever is going awry in those biomarkers. For example, epigenetic type drugs, like Epizyme is a company, and there are other companies, especially in the heme path area where it's kind of close to chemotherapy, but I think it can be a little bit more target specific. But I think it opens up therapy a lot more if you broaden your scope to look for other machinery.
Absolutely. And how would you foresee screening patients for these telltale alterations that may have some prognostic consequences?
Geez, that's a good question. How do we screen for them? Well, first we have to find them. And I think, you know, someone said, this is a scientist who told me like 10 years ago, it's not just one, but it's a signature that you have to find. In our world, specificity and sensitivity are huge, right? You want to be accurate, but you also want it to be able to capture it in your cohort. So once we find an accurate signature, I mean, I think that's step number one. I personally feel like we haven't done that yet in lung cancer. And that's kind of the reason why I was interested in it. So I don't know if I can actually really answer step two, you know, as to how we can use it to implement. I think we're still at step one, to be honest.
It all sounds really promising, though, and an incredible way to think of it and bring ourselves out of the paradigm that we're in now and really broaden our horizons. Think about the ways that these tumors might be acting that can inform how we treat our patients in the future. It's been fascinating to discuss these promising developments in the field of cardiovascular transplantation and in thoracic neoplasia. Dr. Glass, your valuable contributions to diagnostics and prognostication improve the care that we deliver to our patients and further the understanding of the interplay really between disease and therapeutics. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
You're very welcome, Melanie. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
This concludes this episode of the Society for Cardiovascular Pathology podcast. We welcome new members of any experience level to enjoy the collegiality that our society brings to our careers. Visit us on the web at www.scvp.net to learn more.